Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. David Carpenter, the Trailside Killer, had a brutal, seemingly uncontrollable stutter. That is, until he took control and became brutal himself. Surviving victims and pathologists would later describe the eerie transformation of a man who initially seemed genuinely insecure, sweaty, fidgety, literally trying to spit words out, but once comfortable, say with a gun pointed to the back of a woman in the woods, he simply smoothed out, soothed, seemingly, by his own sadism. While being interrogated, Carpenter lamented that as a child, his mother had forced him into ballet. When a detective shared that his own mother had enrolled him against his will to dance, the killer's eyes lit up behind those thick glasses of his. A wooden smile creaked open, revealing teeth better left hidden. And then he rose to perform a slow pirouette. This detail made me nervous. And I don't know why. And I share it up front to grab your attention as it just grabbed mine. Because with all this performative nonsense most serial killers indulge in, this felt truly unhinged. And the detectives there to witness it, not yet certain that they had their man, became certain. As not only did this unassuming, balding, bespectacled man with a short brown beard, dressed like an eccentric professor of an Ivy League school, become subtly confident during that slow, silent dance, he became instantly terrifying. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The Trailside Killer. David Joseph Carpenter was born May 6, 1930, in San Francisco, which is pretty amazing considering he's still alive. Why is he still alive? Will be a question later asked, but for now, it's how. 96 years old, and David, judging by that stutter, had been pretty stressed out the whole time. His most recent prison photo shows a blob of a man, pasty white, formerly 5'10", but he's shrunk a couple inches. Hard to believe he's still here, and his victims have been gone for nearly half a century. The idea that we all have an expiration date, that our time may be predetermined, is ludicrous. David Carpenter should have been dead a long time ago. He's long past his expiration date. Maybe that's why he looks like spoiled milk in his most recent mugshot. David Carpenter was relentlessly bullied throughout his childhood, and it continues here now. This bullying likely happened because his mother dressed him up like a doll, a little lord, an English Nancy. Short pants, high socks, shiny shoes, a blouse, a kerchief. The kids called him Fancy Pants. David tried to call them names back, but couldn't as he had an unbelievably bad stutter. And I won't take pot shots at stuttering. Actually, I will. But if you have a problem with me picking on a serial killer, then I guess call the cops. I'm picking on him, not just people with fucking, you get it. It's a tough spot for a kid to be stuttering. You're stuttering because you're nervous, and the threat of the stutter itself coming out of you makes you more nervous. What a nightmare. Probably best to stay quiet. Sad stuff. And David was growing up in a time, the early 1900s, where people didn't have much patience or sympathy for what was known then as a stuttering fool. But he wasn't a fool. David, in fact, was highly intelligent, which made him even more annoying. I've always thought of people who are picked on but apparently have a high intellect. I think of them and say to myself, figure it out if you're so smart. Figure out how to fit in, how to stop being so fucking annoying. But I suppose there's different types of smart. David was slippery smart. He dropped out by grade 10 for his behavioral issues, but soon finished his education in juvie. He was quite the liar, an excellent manipulator, using his awkward disposition and his lifelong stutter to his advantage. the type long described as one who wouldn't harm a fly. But David did harm flies. As a boy, he was known to catch them in class and rip their wings off for amusement. David was also known to harm cats and dogs. What else was he known for? He pissed his pants a lot. He set fires. The McDonald combo. David molested his cousins and was violent in the process, using knives to threaten his earliest victims. The first time he was sexually aggressive, David recalled being just 8 years old, forcing a little girl to take her pants, then panties off. David Carpenter would blame his mother and his oft-absent and alcoholic father, a postal worker, for his derangements. Mother would beat him constantly. David later claimed he only got a couple days off a year from beatings. Childhood acquaintances would later verify that David Carpenter would always have bruises on him. In one class photo, the little boy, dressed like a sailor, sports a black eye. Mother couldn't stand his stutter. It was a major embarrassment. She also hated that her son was left-handed and that he required a strong prescription for thick eyeglasses. Because his peers picked on him so much, Mother kept David indoors most of the time, off of school, coddling him between beatings. She was overbearing, mothering the ever-loving shit out of the boy, kissing him on the lips 1 minute, busting them open the next for not being able to spit out the words, "I love you too, mother. She refused to allow him to play sports. Instead, what was this witch's name? Elwood? No, that was the father, a real pussy. Elwood, the father, later left the family because his wife was the biggest bully in all this. Frances was her name. Frances forced her boy into ballet instead of baseball and to play violin, which David, as I mentioned in the beginning, resented. He blamed his seething anger, his stutter, his sexual deviance later, on his childhood experiences. Though David Carpenter wasn't just a product of his nurture, in his nature was something that one day would lead him into nature with a gun and some rope. A few criminal incidents marked his formative years. The first, literally, after he viciously bit a fellow student. The second, at the age of 8, when he forced that little girl to pull her pants down. The third was where he got into an argument with a girl in high school, which ended with David dragging the girl down a hallway by her hair. A bit of a red flag. There were too many red flags to count. He lit fires, pissed his pants, harmed animals. He stuttered and was a ballet dancer. Not a good one either. Who would have thought that wearing a tutu and practicing a pirouette wouldn't turn a boy's confidence around? Anyways, in 1944, around the end of World War II, 14-year-old David Carpenter was sent away to Napa State Hospital, previously known as Napa Asylum for the Insane. Young Carpenter was sent to the imposing institution for unreported sexual deviancy. The asylum at that time had a Gothic structure for a face, overlooking the Napa Valley, known as the Castle. The Gorilla Strangler, whom I covered in episode 24 of Dark Topic, Earl Nelson, spent some time going bananas in there, walking around on his hands. Speaking of hands, Carpenter was pretty bad with his. At the age of 17, he would be sent to juvie after molesting two cousins of his in a public washroom, an 8-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl. He threatened them with a knife and with his dog, apparently. Quote, "My dog will bite you if you don't do what I say." The cousins told on David and he spent a year in jail before being sent back to the asylum for further evaluation. In this case, we know he was accused of forcing oral copulation on the children. David Carpenter was paroled in December of 1948 at the age of 18. He had a history of escapes and was considered a shrewd character who was highly likely to reoffend as an adult. David himself, through that disarming stutter, would tell acquaintances, he had no friends, that he had raped around 50 girls by the age of 18. Carpenter, as I mentioned, was a compulsive liar, but even if 10% of that claim were true, and it probably was, the asylum was releasing a patient who wouldn't just one day be prolific, he already was, in rape. The young man was insatiable sexually, a prince of perversion, who never should have left the castle. A prison doctor would later say this of the young delinquent, David Carpenter, quote, "David is a Enterprising, capable, energetic, versatile, exacting, individualistic, verbally facile, persuasive, and sentimental person. Though he certainly has poor impulse control. End quote. Carpenter's father owned a shipping express business that serviced the San Francisco docks, and David ended up working there once at a juvie. He was staying with his parents at the age of 20 and would continue to off and on throughout his early adult life. David's father had by then returned to the home and reconciled with his wife, who was going blind, and neither of them would be able to see what was coming next for their boy. August 5th, 1950. 20-year-old David Carpenter's parents go on holiday, and their son takes advantage of the empty home on Sussex Street. Sex is exactly what he's looking for when, after offering a 17-year-old girl to drive her to a friend's, he detours to his home and invites her in while he gets something. That something would turn out to be his dick from his pants. The girl runs to the bathroom and locks the door, then climbs out the window. David is soon arrested, but like his near victim, manages to wriggle away. The 17-year-old survivor's story wasn't enough. Carpenter claimed that she had given him the wrong idea and pled not guilty. The unassuming and affable young man spoke of wanting to join the Navy and get on with his life. He was sorry for any trouble. He couldn't seem to avoid it, but meant no harm. His lawyer portrayed Carpenter as a painfully awkward and misunderstood young man with plenty of potential. A jury believed this. The stuttering helped big time. They acquitted him in October. This is 1950. It was likely assumed that the young woman had put herself in a position where the wrong idea was taken and that she should have known better. Carpenter stammers a thank you to them. Then, as he promised, heads off to sea. What else he can get away with? He briefly joined the service but was soon honorably discharged from the Coast Guard. A long career wasn't in the cards with his criminal record, not to mention poor eyesight and trouble communicating. Carpenter then drifted into work that suited a man who liked access and authority without having to be the obvious threat. In the mid-1950s, he signed on as a ship's purser. And a purser, for anyone wondering, is the officer who runs the money and the paperwork on a vessel, passenger accounts, crew payroll, immigration forms, customs declarations, lost luggage complaints, the guy passengers go to when something's wrong or when they need something handled quietly. On paper, it's administrative. In practice, it puts you in other people's cabins, in their business, and in their faces for an entire voyage. Carpenter worked the SS Fleetwood. One woman who crossed paths with him on a trip to Japan later came forward decades later. She remembered the thick glasses, the stutter, and the way he hovered around her 14-year-old daughter, even writing a message and signing the girl's travel book at the end of the voyage. This mother still had David Carpenter's signature in her daughter's book, her travel book, when she called the police in 1981, 30 years later, certain that a sketch she'd seen in the papers of a serial killer on the loose was the same man. David Carpenter, no matter what one would think of him, always left an impression. He couldn't help it. There was too much going on inside not to spill out a little every time he spoke or sputtered. That's another spit joke about stuttering. I gotta lay off the stuttering. I mean, I feel real bad for people who stutter. I just can't help it with this guy. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Carpenter tried to hold himself together, tried pretending to be ordinary, but it was difficult. He just couldn't seem to connect with anybody. Some say he was a lot like his mother. Bitchy, prone to gossip. Thought he was better than everyone else, when in reality, he was much worse. In 1955, at 25, he married 19-year-old Ellen Heedle. They had three children. From the outside, it looked like the rehabilitated man, husband, father, working stiff. Inside the house, it was different. Ellen later told authorities that her husband had an enormous sexual appetite, demanding intercourse three times a night. Three times a night seems like a lot. That's 20 times a week, 80 times a month. Hopefully, he was quick. Unlike a conversation with David where you'd be left waiting for him to spit it out, just gotta help guys like Dave finish is all. Their sentences. Speaking of, I kind of forget what I was talking about. Oh yeah, he wanted a lot of sex, and he was going to get it, no matter what. By 1960, the mask was slipping, probably from whacking off too furiously. Carpenter was 30 years old and having trouble keeping himself under control when it came to being around other women. Here's a clip from a rare interview with Carpenter This from prison in his 50s. He's asked about his mindset towards women pre-crime spree.
Your attorney said, this is a quote, David Carpenter is a man who is out of control. He is a mess. He is a personally damaged human being and not capable of weighing the consequences of a decision to kill. Are you a mess? Are you out of control?
No.
A damaged human being?
No, but I used to be.
Told a psychiatrist that the way you deal with stress is to rape the nearest female. Is that a lie?
That's a long time ago. I said that probably when I was maybe 30, and I'm 55 years old now. So what you're talking about is something that was in a report that's 25, something that I did 25 years ago.
And that doesn't describe you now?
No.
Tuesday, July 12th, 1960, 8:30 a.m. 30-year-old David Carpenter is sizing up what he believes will be his first murder victim. He drives down San Francisco's Green Street in his 53 Oldsmobile. Sources say the shadow of Alcatraz would have been in the distance, bobbing in the ocean. Alive still, but soon to be shut down, following an infamous escape only two summers away. But that's another story, maybe you've heard it. All throughout this case, apparently the scenery was quite captivating, despite the captives being captured, not just by Alcatraz, but by another shadow of the coast, soon to be known as the Trailside Killer. Carpenter is hunting a woman this morning, 32-year-old Lois D'Andrade. She knew Carpenter and his wife. The Carpenters had invited Lois over for her 31st birthday at David's behest. He worked with Lois on occasion. She was a secretary for a company that did business with his father's shipping service. Often when off the boats, not being a purser, and on shore, David would spend time in the offices bothering the women. And Lois was one of the few who had been kind to him, which didn't pay off. Being nice to men like Carpenter is to give them the wrong idea, unfortunately. Lois is walking to the bus stop when David pulls up alongside her and throws the passenger door open. Need a ride? Lois, a pretty, kind woman, politely tells David that she is fine. David has been calling her once a month or so for years, staying in touch, keeping her updated on his life, prying into hers. Got a boyfriend yet? Carpenter insists that she come with him. He tells Lois he wants to bring her to see his wife and their new baby. Don't you want to see the baby, Lois? Lois again declines, telling David she needs to get to work. Well, get in then. I'll have you there early. Just a quick visit, Lois. Please? Lois, because she's a good person, unlike myself, relents. David, because he's a bad person, persists. Call her weak if you prefer, but that's not fair, especially since it's not true. Lois gets in and David drives off, distracting his prey with a flurry of one-sided, stuttered conversation until he has her where he wants her, out in the woods, a Presidio military base. When Lois asks why they're driving so far into the woods, David just continues talking about everything except what's happening. Lois knows something is wrong. Something's always been wrong with David. So she plays along, not wanting to set the clearly disturbed David Carpenter off. There's something in his eyes, something about his whole demeanor that has shifted dangerously. A quote from Lois. His speech was very clear. He did not stammer at all. David had a really bad stammer, and from the time he picked me up, the whole while, he did not stammer. End quote. Finally, David began rolling to a stop in a treed area that seemed private enough. Speaking to himself, flatly and as if in resignation, he said, "Oh man, I think I'm really in trouble. Then he lunged at Lois, but she was already moving. The passenger door flew open as the car stopped. She was halfway out when David snatched at the empty air where she'd been a second earlier. He caught her before she got far, dragged her back in, straddled her in the seat, reached into the glove box and pulled out a knife and rope. He began binding her wrists, but Lois fought him off. Then he put the knife to her throat and said calmly, 'If you make any more noise or continue to struggle, I'll kill you.' Then his voice grew into something Lois had never heard from David. Husky, lurid, vampiric. He was drooling with lust. He he repeated himself. Clearly, I do not want to hurt you, Lois, but I'll kill you if you're not quiet. I have this funny quirk that needs to be satisfied. She believes him. Carpenter begins, and at some point he reaches under his seat for a hammer. From Lois, I saw there was a road up above, and I saw a vehicle go by, and instinctively, I guess, I went for the horn, and the knife was there, and I lunged forward, and I guess I honked the horn. I screamed. It's all chaos. From everyone involved's later account, including David's, the car had been that of a military policeman, Officer Jewel Wayne Hicks. Hicks is alerted by the honking. He comes to a stop up above. There's roads traveling up and around through the forest here and crossroads. He hears the screams from his open window. It's a hot day. Hicks turns his green patrol car around and heads down the dirt road towards the screams, through the woods, towards those savage sounds. Meanwhile, Carpenter is slashing his knife at Lois, who manages to escape as he lacerates the fingers on her right hand, which he holds up in protection. Lois runs from the Oldsmobile, but is soon tackled from behind by Carpenter, who begins raining down blows with a claw hammer, hitting her in the head, one blow smashing her watch, the crystal shattering. The officer pulls up and hops out with his baton raised, hand grasping for his .45 military automatic, and he sees what appears to be a rape, evolved to attempted murder, going on in the dirt. A quote from Officer Hicks, "Even when he saw me coming down the hill, he kept hitting her." Lois had been hit half a dozen times in the head with a hammer, but she's still conscious when Carpenter stops swinging and decides to run. He is quickly halted by the officer, who shouts out a warning. The gun is drawn. Carpenter slowly begins to retrieve his own. A gun one could draw with. It's a pen. A small gun shaped like a fountain pen. Something you might see in a James Bond movie. Fitting for David Carpenter, the sly, unassuming villain. He drops the claw hammer and puts his hands up. One thumb is missing, literally, though the stub of it is curled around the inconspicuous weapon in the palm of his hand, much like this ever-evolving situation he has in the palm of his hand. MP Hicks orders the docile, defeated deviant to the back of his vehicle. He hears raspy breathing and looks down to the woman whose life he's just saved. For now. Lois's skull is clearly fractured. She's alive, but gurgling and fading from blood loss. What a morning this has turned out to be. Hicks reaches into his vehicle to call for backup, and Carpenter fires his pen gun. A propelled tear gas cartridge explodes into white smoke. Hicks has turned his face directly into the small explosion. He is burned by it. David Carpenter had just one shot. The pen gun is single use, but it's been effective here. He attempts to flee while the distraction of the tear gas works like a magician's trick. Gone in a puff of smoke, the vicious, cunning rapist seems to be. But then the smoke clears, and it's just a balding, bearded, bespectacled hunchback running away down the dirt road. Carpenter is no athlete. He's made it less than 10 feet when the officer's own gun goes off multiple times. Carpenter is hit in the back through his belly and then in the leg. He shouts out in pain, then goes tumbling into the brush at roadside. This bastard, David Carpenter, would have been raping Lois, then finishing her off with a hammer, had he been able to kill MP Hicks. But he hadn't, and now he begs for mercy. Don't shoot. You've hit me. Begging like a baby when Hicks secures the arrest, Lois, in a dazed panic, jumps into Carpenter's car and attempts to start it. The keys are in the ignition still, but she can't seem to grasp them. It's something out of a nightmare. Inside a nightmare. Finally, she realizes that her fingers aren't working because they've been severed and are hanging from her hand. Then she is being pulled from the car by two officers who have just arrived for backup. It's all a haze. Lois has a major skull injury and needs medical attention badly. She is being put into the back of a car. As she gets in, Lois recoils and stumbles away from the vehicle, refusing to get back in. David Carpenter, hands cuffed behind him, is sitting in the back seat of the car they're attempting to put her into. "It's okay. It's okay," says Carpenter. "I won't hurt you anymore. I can't hurt you." Lois, apparently, and I find this hard to believe, did eventually get in with David in the back seat of the squad car, and they were rushed off to hospital for their injuries.
which would have been a pretty awkward car ride. What's David like? Can we stop to see my baby, Lois? But I believe this detail of her being in the back seat is not true. In later interviews with Lois, she does not mention this, though books I've read do. I think there's enough going on in this incredible survivor story without stretching the truth. Lois was likely pushed to sit with David by officers not understanding what had happened, then gave her a separate ride they probably did. Lois would end up having a metal plate put in her head and have her fingers reattached. She lost her sense of smell, but saved her own life by acting when it mattered most. Speaking of acting, Lois would go on to get married and have a daughter, Lisa Rinna, the actress and reality TV star best known for Days of Our Lives, Melrose Place, and The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I don't know her very well. I probably fucked her last name up. But that's a big part of the story when it comes to Lois's. She survives and has a child who becomes quite famous. David Carpenter went on to do a lot of acting himself. While in hospital, he claimed to have no recollection of the attack. It seemed his strategy would be an amnesia defense. But on March 9th of 1961, while facing sentencing for the assaults on both Lois and MP Hicks, Carpenter suddenly claimed to remember, probably because he felt the case wasn't going his way and saw this sudden change as a way to either drag things out or further support his amnesia claim. Coming back to consciousness on the events, David Carpenter told the judge that while recently watching Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho film, he experienced a flood of memory on what he had done. The judge only stared at Carpenter in that patient way those waiting out a brutal stuttering show are wont to do. Then he said this, quote, "You, sir, suffer only from a sociopathic personality disturbance." David Carpenter, in front of his soon-to-be ex-wife, holding their infant child, was then sentenced to serve 14 years in prison. Since the attack happened on federal property, Carpenter was not sent to Alcatraz, rather the U.S. Penitentiary at McNeil Island in Washington. He would serve the minimum of 9 years and be released on April 7th of 1969. All through his incarceration, Carpenter claimed that Lois had attacked him first, with a knife, kind of like that shower scene in Psycho, except in a car, and the genders reversed. An incredible liar, a bad one. A master manipulator, though, who would use every disadvantage he had to his advantage. I don't know about you all, or y'all, but I am a protein guy. I'm talking beef, chicken, seafood, burgers, I guess that's beef, pork chops, sides, and I like them delivered directly to my door. That's why I use Omaha Steaks. That's America's original butcher since 1917. This keeps my freezer stocked with restaurant-quality protein. So whether it's a rushed weeknight or a Saturday cookout, you can have quality protein on hand when you need it. So what I love about Omaha Steaks is that they are higher average than your average grocery meats. I'm a big ribeye guy myself. And I know that they got the butcher's cut difference. That's carved thicker and taller, trimmed at least twice. Cooks evenly and harder to overcook are their steaks. Perfectly aged, 30 plus days. This is all exclusive to Omaha Steaks. They prepare the protein the way that I prefer. But that's just for the special occasions, those ribeyes. They also got those juicy burgers for a cookout. Grilling chicken, which they slow chill, keeping the moisture intact, the flavor. Seafood, pork chops, and gourmet franks. Omaha Steaks has what you want. They have delicious sides like pre-made scalloped potatoes. They have desserts and more. A great dinner is minutes away when you're hooked up with Omaha Steaks. It's like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop at home. No more gambling on unknown brands. Omaha Steaks has earned its reputation over 100 years. It's the same beef trusted in kitchens across the country, shipped straight to yours. Steakhouse quality without the steakhouse prices. Your family will think dinner took hours, not minutes. Frozen delivery can be good. Omaha Steaks is known for their meticulous aging process and vacuum-sealed individual packaging, as I mentioned. In all my excitement, maybe I didn't mention it. And it's shipped nationwide. Arrives frozen, ready for grilling, searing, and roasting with minimal effort and time. If you've never tried them, Burger Perfection Flight is the perfect introduction to Omaha Steaks. For just $79.99, you get 20 premium steak burgers crafted from 5 distinct cuts of steak, each with its own unique flavor profile and texture. The Burger Perfection Flight includes 4 pure ground filet mignon burgers, 4 pure ground New York strip burgers, 4 pure ground ribeye burgers, 4 pure ground brisket burgers, my favorite, 4 pure ground sirloin burgers. I love them all. Now I'm dribbling on myself. Mama, where's my rag? Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com. Promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Once free, David Carpenter began living with his brother and attending group therapy classes. There he met a woman named Helen, who he hit it off with, sexually, and soon married. Some reports say that David initially wanted to rape the woman, but when she went along with his advances, he just kind of went along with her, and eventually married her. And that story could be mixed up with another girl later on. It's not clear to me. Some of this information is a bit mixed up, but there is a girl at some point here who he, you know, the sex is a big thing for him. He needs it 3 times a night. And even that's not enough, you'll come to find. Well, often we'll talk about rape quick, because I'm a guy who should be talking about it. Often people talk about it being a power thing, not a sex thing. Yes. In this case, it seems that he was like a nymphomaniac. So a lot of it was a sex thing, and he felt he couldn't get it, so he was going to take it. Clearly he had some issues. Clearly he had some issues with his mother, and that probably had something to do with a hatred towards women as well. So I'm sure a guy who stutters wants to regain some power as well, right? So there is a power aspect to it, but it's got to be known that this guy was a fucking sex maniac. Though, and I had this brought to my attention recently by my girl, she said 1993 was when it became possible for you to be charged as a husband for raping your wife in the States. It took until 1993 for the system to recognize that husbands can rape their wives. So those 3 sexual encounters a night that he needed from his first wife, I mean, maybe they all were rape. He's forcing her to fucking have sex, and she probably doesn't want it all that time. And that's a power thing as well, right? He's dominating her. I'm in a fucking jar of pickles here, and I'm having trouble getting the fucking lid unscrewed. So he stopped checking in with his parole officer at about a year in to his parole. He's supposed to hang in there for until 1974. It's only 1970 when he stops communicating with his parole officer, and this didn't really raise any alarms because David had gotten married, secured a job, and had been attending therapy. It seemed that he was all good. Then his new wife went on vacation, and David stayed home. He found himself driving aimlessly around South Bay, eventually into Santa Cruz, California. There he forced a car off the highway, which contained a pretty girl he'd spotted. The girl jumped out of her car and ran into the brush, successfully hiding from this odd man who stuttered out to her that they needed to exchange information. She sensed something dangerous about him and saved her own life in this case. He gave up the chase and drove his 65 Volkswagen further south to Boulder Creek, where just after 10 p.m., the extremely horny Carpenter, so horny he could barely see the road in front of him, fueled by an insatiable need to rape, found a victim. 19-year-old was driving home from her parents' house on a lonely stretch of California Highway 9 when she's rear-ended and sent into the ditch. Carpenter gets out and comes as if to assist the girl, who is yelling at the meek-seeming man as he approaches, stuttering. He's learned from the first attempt here that he needs not to come running with a knife. He needs to come up meekly with his hands, massive hands, held together as if in repentance. Carpenter, as his name might suggest, had strong hands. He was all around quite strong. He just held himself, dressed himself, presented himself as meek. Cheryl had no idea who she was messing with as this man blankly stared at her through his thick prison-issue glasses while she berated him for causing the accident. When she got out, it's dark, her headlights are still on, but it's a dark, lonely highway. She gets out and starts pointing at the damage, turning her back to David. David pulls out his paring knife he'd been using to cut himself slices of salami and cheese and pickle on this little road trip, rape trip, and wraps an arm around her throat, pointing the knife at her face as he whispers huskily, clearly, quote, "I want to rape you. I'll have to kill you if you don't come with me." He then ripped her dress down to her waist, balling it up in his large hand, then dragged her up an embankment at a sight from the road. Cheryl struggled, and in the process, her arms and hands became cut up by David's knife. And what happened next was unexpected. Carpenter's whole demeanor changed. He was like a stammering child, upset to see the blood. He grabbed Cheryl by the wrists, looked into her eyes, and said, quote, "Look, you're hurt and bleeding. Let me follow you home and bandage you up if you promise not to call the police." What the fuck is going on here with David? I mean, not the stuttering, just like, what's with this whole change? And he does do what he's talking about here, trying to talk about. He fixes Cheryl's dress. He brings her back to her car, puts her into it, then gets into his own. Cheryl, like you, like me, can't believe this turn of events. She begins to drive and watches through her rear view. Her attackers slowly begin to follow her at a safe distance. Once she gets into town, Cheryl pulls into a public space, and David, finally snapping out of whatever the hell that was, speeds away. Spooked. I'm spooked. David Carpenter is legitimately nuts. Something out of a Hitchcock film. Cheryl memorizes her attacker's license plate number and calls it into police, then asks for medical attention. David, by the sounds of things, could use some himself. He needs his head checked. Seriously, Dave, I don't like you or what you're up to here, but, like, are you okay? What was that all about? We have this idea that this guy is manipulative and a liar, and he's setting people up to think that he's meek and then taking advantage of them and dragging them into the woods and raping them. And then in this instance, he feels bad and reverts to a childlike state and lets the girl go. He's not okay. Carpenter drives home in the car his wife owns to the apartment in her name. He gets out of his bloody clothes, takes a shower. He's putting on new clothes when a loud knock comes at the door. It's now the middle of the night. That can only be the police. David runs out his back balcony, climbs down a fire escape, evading the San Francisco PD with ease. They're likely still knocking and announcing themselves when David disappears down the street. He eventually finds an abandoned house, goes inside, and falls asleep on the floor. He's not afraid of the druggies and bums that cohabitate this den. David Carpenter knows that he is the thing to be afraid of in the dark. The next morning, he hitchhiked to Santa Cruz, then aimlessly walked into the woods until he found a cottage, the home of William, a schoolteacher, wife, and mother of two young boys. Nobody is home. Wilma will be returning around 3 p.m. with her sons following the school day. When she eventually does, she is surprised to find her husband home early. He appears to be sitting quietly waiting for them in the sunroom. He's wearing his robe. He's holding his shotgun. Wilma approaches her home with the boys, 7 and 3 years old. She opens the door and begins asking her husband, what is the matter? Then she realizes that it's not her husband. David Carpenter, wearing the man of the house's clothes, holding his 16-gauge shotgun, looks to the mother and her kids, then speaks. That bitch last night got excited and there was blood all over the place. David then tells the boys to go to their rooms. He escorts Wilma to her vehicle with the shotgun to her back. He calmly directs her to drive. They travel to an old cabin that his parents owned in the 40s. It's empty. Inside, David rapes Wilma. He demands her hands stay behind her back as he commits this act. Wilma complies, and she survives. When David is done, he appears cheery. He takes Wilma to her car, a Mercedes-Benz, puts her in the passenger side, then, wearing her husband's jacket and hat, drives her home. He drops Wilma off as if they had just enjoyed an afternoon date, then drives away slowly out from the woods, away from the cottage, with his window down. He hangs out, waves, and calls out to Wilma from the vehicle, quote, "I'm sorry. I'm sick. I need help. I'm just lonely." The next morning, January 29th, 1970, while being tracked down for his crimes, David kidnaps 25-year-old Sharon from a parking garage in Daly City. He ties her up at gunpoint, puts her in the Mercedes, then begins the task of switching Sharon's license plates with the stolen cars. While doing this, Sharon manages to escape, running from the garage, screaming for help. Shit! Carpenter then gets into his would-be victim's car and drives off. Though he soon realizes that he now has the license plates of a stolen car on another stolen car, and both have no doubt been reported. Fuck! Carpenter disappears for nearly a week, laying low, sleeping in the woods. He does this a lot. He's okay with just laying down in the woods. Until February 3rd, 1970, when he reemerges to rob a cleaning lady, who he ties to a bed, takes her car keys and $3. No time for rape. But he made up for that 45 minutes later when he barged into the home of a 25-year-old housewife. She had her infant son with her, but no matter. Carpenter had her drive him in her vehicle to a predetermined camping location of his. There he raped the mother in front of her child, then asked she give him a lift to a Greyhound station in Oakdale. Yeah, sure, no problem. On the drive, David bounced the baby on his knee and seemed cheerful. This woman later commented on how David was kind to both her and the baby once he'd gotten what he wanted, that being forced sex at gunpoint in front of her kid. Yeah, he's a little rough around the edges, but deep down, not too bad of a guy. I don't get it. I mean, this is the 70s. This is 1970. People handled things a little different then. Went and rolled with the punches, it seemed. And the rapes. David Carpenter clearly in some kind of fucking wild psychotic break here. Some nightmarish land of completely being out of his fucking mind and then being back in it and just causing all kinds of fucking mayhem. He walks around with a pistol at this point that he traded the shotgun for. He leaves the vehicle and the mother goes to nearby police. They soon arrive at the station she dropped him off at, the Greyhound station, and they arrest David. He has a hit kit on him, ropes, knives, a gun. It's thought that during this period, which seemed like a psychotic break, David did more damage than we'll ever know, but this period of his life, these years leading to the infamous Trailside killings, are often underreported, forgotten. You may have heard this case before, but I doubt that you've heard all this. I hadn't. Truly, though, I keep talking about a psychotic break. This likely was no break. This was just David being David, allowing his, you know, freak flag to fly. David is put in jail to await a long list of charges. The investigation into his recent crime spree is going to take a while to fully investigate. David uses this time to plan a jailbreak with fellow inmates. Monday, April 27th, 1970, almost a year since being paroled, Carpenter, who is known by his nickname Zodiac to other prisoners, as he's claiming to be the Zodiac killer, active at this time, Carpenter leads a plan to break through a skylight after having organized the cutting of cell bars. Easy enough somehow. He and four others escape, but are recaptured hours later in a field surrounding the jail, this by bloodhounds. On May 1st of 1970, David J. Carpenter is sent back to prison, where he belongs, for a spree of theft, kidnapping, rape, and general terrorization of these prolific serial killer stomping grounds. I mean, who do we have out here? The Zodiac? Ted Bundy's around? I mean, he confessed to a couple in California, Bundy did, but you know, he was never charged with any of them. Kemper at some point. There is a long list. I mean, the Golden State Killer. So Carpenter is sent to Folsom Prison, then transferred to San Quentin, like a Johnny Cash song. In fact, Carpenter nearly was at both prisons for the infamous Johnny Cash prison performances. He missed them only by a year he spent causing the kind of mayhem such music makes sound kind of cool, though usually it's just kind of sick. These prisoners are no heroes, hard done by or whatever. Most of them that Johnny Cash is singing to probably had raped women. David Carpenter served his time. He did the therapy, read the books, kept his nose clean, though he was often suspected of being behind certain schemes. A quote from a prison guard who watched over David during his time in prison, quote, Carpenter was the kind of guy who could be standing in a rainstorm and lie about the weather. He could also get people to do things for him under the guise of innocent assignments. End quote. Though sent away with a suggestion he should never be let go, Carpenter manages to weasel into parole. By 1977, he quickly was rearrested and sent back to prison in Washington for parole violations stemming from his previous parole conditions. Turns out he wasn't allowed to kidnap and rape women while briefly released. On May 21st, 1979, just after his 49th birthday, Carpenter was paroled to a San Francisco halfway house. That summer, he joined a hiking group and began walking the trails of the so-called Sleeping Lady, Mount Tamalpais. The mountain, surrounded by forest, resembles a woman lying on her back. Unfortunately, because of David Carpenter's release and subsequent fascination with the trails surrounding the lady, the name would take on a whole new meaning once the Trailside Killer began his infamous killing spree, one that we will walk the paces of together next time on Dark Topic. Eyes Cocked, Doors Locked, Stay Paranoid. I'll talk at you real soon. Like right now. August 19th, 1979. A Sunday. 44-year-old bank executive Etta Kane drives her Volkswagen Rabbit out to the hiking trails of the Sleeping Lady. Her older husband, John, dealing with an arthritis flare-up in his knees, decides to stay home. A regular hiking friend is busy with church duties, so Etta is alone when she heads out into the woods to meet her cruel fate. She leaves her vehicle in the parking lot of the Mountain Home Inn. The hike will take her to the highest peak of Mount Tamalpais, the East Peak, overlooking surrounding forest, reservoirs, the Pacific, fellow mountains, sleeping ladies. Somewhere below lurks David Carpenter, clutching a cannon, a stolen .44 caliber bulldog. The son of Sam, David Berkowitz, used the same snub-nosed revolver, a weapon far too powerful for what should be quiet work. But to be fair, neither killer truly knew what they were doing, or so they claim. Carpenter wears a hooded windbreaker. With his glasses and beard, he's the late Unabomber sketch. A German plastic surgeon, excellent with facial recognition, will be on the trails this day and provide a completely different profile of a suspicious blonde-haired man he'd walked past that will lead investigators down the wrong path. When Etta fails to return home by dusk, her husband John decides he must go to see if she's okay. Finding the Volkswagen Rabbit hunched over and lonely in the darkening parking lot, John decides he must hit the trail. His knees are on fire, but the icy fear one feels in such situations dulls the pain enough for him to try and find his wife. He calls out for Etta, stumbling through the darkness of what was then considered a safe trail. No murder had ever been reported in this area before John finally gave in, went home, and called police. A cadaver dog finds her the next afternoon. Etta Kane is 60 feet above a main trail in a clearing under a canopy of trees, sun shining through, twinkling over her hunched over, kneeling, naked body, save a sock, face down on the forest floor, as if in prayer. The hole in the back of her head, the size of it, makes the scene even more shocking. It's later determined that she had not been raped, though oral copulation couldn't be ruled out. A quote from the husband here, holding his knees when he heard his wife had been found. And in what condition? Quote, "If it hadn't been for my damn knees, I would have been with her. The guy took 3 credit cards and $10. He didn't take her wedding ring. He didn't take her jewelry. He didn't rape her. What the hell did the sumbitch want?" End quote. I want to take a moment to recognize my main source and the reason I have such personal quotes. The Sleeping Lady by Robert Graysmith does the best job of retelling the case of the Trailside Killer, in my opinion. I have a link to his book in the show notes. John Kane was suspected of his wife's murder for some time. He had been at the trail, after all, had come out of there sweating and disheveled after his effort to supposedly find his wife. But suspicion went away as the months brought more murders to the previously pristine Sleeping Lady. A mountain clean of crime, until suddenly soaked by it here in the late 70s, early 80s. The husband John Kane, in his 60s, was under surveillance, but the widowed man was truly broken by his wife Etta's murder. All he did was sit around drinking beer and watching cartoons. Mourning. Investigators hoped he would turn out to be a killer, and they could quell the community's fears of a random murderer on the mountain, but it quickly became obvious, as the killings continued, that unless John Kane was somehow channeling the violence of Looney Tunes and psychically sending oversized bullets racing down the trails, there was a serial killer on the loose. The trailside killer seemed to come from nowhere and everywhere at once, flashing into existence as if from some portal to hell or Toontown. That sucked. A month or so after the grisly murder of Etta Kane on October 21st, 1979, another Sunday, 23-year-old Mary Frances Bennett was attacked while jogging a trail in Land's End of Lincoln Park in San Francisco. Mary, a recent graduate from Montana State University, was dragged into some brush near a golf course and attempted to be raped. Carpenter had with him a knife, and when Mary began screaming, alerting some golfers who are concerned until the screaming stops, Carpenter stabs the young woman 25 times in the back, chest, groin, but many go to her neck to stop her screaming. Mary is nearly decapitated when she is found partially buried in the brush after some hikers see a blood trail and follow it. Carpenter's own blood was in the mix. It would take until 2010 for his DNA to be matched to this case that was a little off the trails, a little off the beaten path he'd mostly stick to. The beaten path had whole new meaning. Carpenter was having trouble early with his techniques. He visited a hospital that evening of Mary Bennett's murder. Carpenter had lacerations on his hands packed with dirt. He claimed a dog had attacked him and was given a tetanus shot. Going forward, he would use something not too big like the .44 revolver, which had, by some reports, dislocated his thumb. The knife had proven not big enough, slippery once wet with blood, sliding into his grip. He'd figure it out, eventually. 5 months later, on March 8, 1980, 23-year-old Barbara Schwartz is hiking up and around the area where Etta Kane had been found, shot in the head, posed as if in prayer. Later, it would be realized that posing was something Carpenter enjoyed doing to his victims. Those who knew him well would tell you that David Carpenter had a wicked sense of humor. He found the most disturbing things funny, and what could be more disturbing than posing a dead woman's body post-rape in a perverse position? It is drizzling off and on this spring afternoon, so Carpenter stalks Barbara in a yellow raincoat. She has a dog with her, a black lab. Dogs aren't allowed on the Sleeping Lady, but ever since Etta Kane's murder, which Barbara is well aware of, she can't relax without the perceived protection of her pup. At around 5:30 p.m., another hiker, a young woman alone, is passing Barbara and her dog on an adjacent trail in an area blooming with wildflowers and watched over by enormous Douglas fir trees. The girl's eyes take in a yellow figure, watching the woman with her dog from off trail. Barbara is picking yellow poppies. Then the yellow man approaches Barbara Schwartz with a butcher knife raised high in his left hand. The witness, unnoticed, stifles a scream when the stabbing begins. The dog is barking. Barbara is barking in pain. The witness is collecting this nightmare to her later recollection. She sees a handsome, sharp-featured man with slicked back, black hair, athletic, no glasses, clean-shaven. He stabs Barbara through the hands, then her neck, and chest. Finally, the witness sees enough and yells out for the man to stop. He does, rushing back into the brush, like a yellow poppy in animation. Barbara Schwartz is still gurgling when the witness comes to her, then, seeing the frightening damage, runs for help. The dog is still barking when park rangers arrive, its owner now dead. Barbara had fought for her life. Ripping prison-issue glasses from Carpenter's face, they lay nearby, beside Barbara. But the completely off description of the attacker by the witness throws everything off. It's as if she saw the scene as something from the movies, so superimposed a movie star's looks on the frumpy character of Carpenter. Or maybe that's what happens when nobody's supposed to be looking. Killers transform into what they see themselves to be. That description sure sounds a lot like Anthony Perkins, Psycho's original Norman Bates. The knife had cut Carpenter again. This will be his last knife attack as a result. He goes to hospital that evening with a large gash in his thumb. He claims to have stopped a robbery at a 7-Eleven and had been slashed by the robber in his heroics. Police are called into the hospital and take down the story, but don't bother to verify it. They instead thank Carpenter for his help. A lot of wackos out there these days, Dave. Sure are. Investigators knew that because the glasses left at the scene were prison-issued, they likely had a killer who was out on parole. Going with the witness's description of a handsome, clean-shaven, athletic man with a full head of hair, unsurprisingly, Carpenter's name never came back to them. An effort to hand out flyers with the details of the glasses to optometrists in the San Francisco area fails to reach David's optometrist's office, where the killer, with two uniquely different eyes, requiring a memorable prescription, would have rung a bell, as he does above his optometrist's door when turning up there soon enough, looking for a replacement pair of glasses. Ironically, David Carpenter and his most recent victim here in Barbara Schwartz shared the same optometrist. And I don't know if any of us saw that one coming. Another bumble in the case occurs when a group of teenagers messing around in the woods come across the discarded 10-inch boning knife Carpenter had used to kill Barbara. It is crusted with blood, and the kids know better than to touch it. Luckily, an Oakland TV crew is nearby, and the kids alert them to the find. One of the crew picks up the knife to examine it, then hands it around. The newscaster holds it up, and they film a short segment on the find. Could this be the weapon used in the recent trailside killings? Investigators get a hold of the weapon too late. The killer's prints have been rubbed off and replaced by the reporters. Carpenter's identity, once again, disguised by a handsome man with a full head of hair. In September of 1980, David Carpenter has a friend buy a .38 caliber revolver for him. This friend, Molly, a former prison pal of David's and sometimes sexual partner, is hesitant to buy an ex-con a gun. Carpenter tells her he needs it because he's in the mafia now. Don't worry, Molly. You're protected by me familia. On October 11th, 1980, Cynthia Moreland, 18 years old, and Richard Stowers, 19, a recently engaged couple, are hiking Point Reyes on the Big Sky Trail. Richard, a recently graduated Coast Guard, is in the area to get familiar with his new station. Maybe Carpenter sees the black bomber jacket with the Coast Guard insignia, sees the pretty girl, and thinks, that could have been me. That should have been me. Maybe. Maybe he was doing a test run with his new weapon. Carpenter, it's thought, forces the couple at gunpoint to turn around, then says a few clear, unkind words. There's no rape or robbery, only the cold-blooded murder of a young couple with their whole lives ahead of them. In fact, they were walking that trail, no doubt dreaming aloud about their future together, as this area was to be their new stomping grounds, a place where one day soon they might have been pushing a stroller, had they not been pushed to their knees before being executed. Gunshots are heard by others walking the trails that day, but there's no real effort to figure out where they came from and why they happened. Police tell the couple's concerned relatives that they probably eloped. But wait, that's what they were already openly doing. That's why they were here. They were eloping to this area when they disappeared. It will take a month for the couple's bodies to be found during a search for more missing hikers, more victims of the trailside killer. During his killing spree, David Carpenter worked in a warehouse that distributed keychains and dolls, and he hated it. With his criminal record, it was unlikely he'd ever get back on track to fulfilling work again, the way he was as a young man in the Coast Guard. But he'd found a way to vent. He'd found a new passion. He begins teaching. And he begins a serial killer career. On October 15th of 1980, 4 days since his first double homicide and still no word of it in the papers, Carpenter is spotted by a caretaker of an inn of Mount Tamalpais, standing strangely on a horseshoe-shaped section of the trail, dressed in a Hawaiian shirt and slacks, just kind of in a daze, not moving, arms limp beside him, meditating, looking into the woods. It turns out that Carpenter had had a tough day at work. He'd been yelled at. The caretaker remembered the odd man because he wasn't dressed for hiking as most people would be. It was as if he drove up here, then got lost, like he was having a mental breakdown and trying to recover himself through meditation looking into the woods. Not long after this, the caretaker goes for a jog. This is when he spots another strange visitor, 26-year-old Ann Alderson, sitting alone in the massive stone Greek amphitheater of this mountainous area. She also appears to be meditating. And she also appears to be at a place with her attire. It's a scene that's hard to believe, but Anne, described by the jogger as a pretty blonde not dressed for hiking, she's in brown leather dress boots, a nice dress, jacket. She appears to be watching a play down below, but there's no people. Only a massive empty stone theater on the mountain, save this lady. It has rained recently. It said her only companions beside her are puddles. She is sitting in a puddle herself, staring at a play that is playing out only in her mind. The jogger thinks to warn her of the recent murders, but decides that would be creepy. Honestly, she's kind of creepy. Like a ghost watching something on a stage only she can see. Perhaps her own life, flashing before her eyes, in the mind of Carpenter, nearby. The sun is setting when the caretaker jogs back through 20 minutes later. The woman, Anne Alderson, is gone. Anne, a research scientist and former member of the Peace Corps, is called in missing the next day by her father, a doctor. A detail to police that makes this somehow more serious than the recent missing couple case, thought to have eloped, even though their vehicle still sits in a lot by a trailhead yet to be discovered. Because of her father's persistence, Anne's vehicle is found in the Mountain Theater parking lot the very next morning. A team of 80 searchers fan out. The inn caretaker is questioned and shares his sunset sighting of Anne. Another witness claims to have seen a woman fitting Anne's description walking a path that turns out to be only half a mile from where the first known trailside murder victim, Etta Kane, had been discovered. That's not good. 2 days into the search, Anne is found along an overgrown telephone line trail, only a quarter mile from the mountain amphitheater. She is near fully dressed, still in her boots, still wearing her expensive jewelry, splayed face up over a boulder on her back, posed, or left as she died, her skirt up, semen-stained panties, legs splayed, a bullet hole in the side of her head. Anne, it appears, had been raped and then executed in the process. It's a sickening scene. Horrifying. One, the killer, no doubt left. Proud. November 28th, 1980. 22-year-old petite blonde Diane O'Connell, a recent graduate of Cornell University, is visiting friends for the Thanksgiving weekend when two of these friends, Nancy and Sharon, suggest they go hike the Big Sky Trail on Point Reyes, where the missing couple, Cynthia Moreland and Richard Stowers, still wait to be found, face down, shot, and hastily covered with brush. The three young women are on their way back down from the three-mile vertical hike when they pass another woman in her early 20s, legal secretary Shauna May, who is on her way up the trail. Diane O'Connell and Shauna May say hello at some point. Soon, they'll be saying goodbye. On the trek down, Diane, who's part of this trio and is in the middle of her trio, becomes isolated. Sharon, her friend, is quicker up ahead, Nancy slower at the rear, and this presents an opportunity for David Carpenter, who's hiding in the woods, to pick off his chosen victim in the petite Diane O'Connell. When her friends reach the bottom and realize Diane is gone, they wait for her, puzzled. It's 3 p.m. when they decide to go back up the trail, but their friend has seemingly vanished. They don't come across the girl they'd passed in Shauna May, either. The girls, knowing about the trailside killings, are so spooked that they immediately rush to a ranger station. There had been a man. They both remember seeing a man watching them from trailside. He'd been saying something to them. Both surviving women here had ignored him because he was creepy, unintelligible, probably due to his stammer. Soon steadied. A search for the girls commences, and 2 days later, two bodies are found, but are far too decomposed to be the missing hikers. These bodies, of course, belong to a couple long thought to have eloped, but now lay decomposing on the side of a slope. One of the searchers at the scene finds he needs to get away from the smell. When he gets a quarter mile away from the stench, it's been gone for a bit, but then somehow returns. Sweeter. He looks into a gully and sees two doll-like naked females, figures lying face down in the leaves, arms over one another as if having plunged together into the afterlife. Their clothing is folded neatly at their heads on top of their backpacks. Diane and Shauna have been together when kidnapped off the trail. It's thought that they were passing one another, Diane coming down, Shauna on her way up, when Carpenter decided to capitalize on a two-for-one opportunity. He had strangled to death the smaller Diane with piano wire after having first gagged her with her own panties. Diane had been finished off with a .38 caliber shot to the head. The bullets left on scene would match that of the Mount Tamalpais Greek theater tragedy involving Ann Alderson. Beside Diane, Shauna has been clearly raped, her naked body laying there along with the naked body of Diane, but Shauna's legs are spread. Semen is found in both her anus and vagina. This semen would later be found to match the theater scene, the Ann Alderson rape murder. It's theorized that Carpenter's intended victim had been the smaller Diane O'Connell, but when Shauna May came along, he had to take both women down. Shauna's a little bit bigger than Diane, and Shauna had interrupted, and perhaps Carpenter's anger and attention then became focused on her. Shauna would have watched Diane be strangled, then shot, before she was brutally raped, her wrist bound by wire behind her back. Shauna also had her panties shoved into her mouth, but they were found on the ground in front of her, ejected from her face when Carpenter was finished with her and decided she needed three point-blank shots to the back of the head. Gruesome details, hard to say. Hard to say that shots to the back of a woman's head who had just finished being raped caused her panties that were stuffed in her mouth as a gag to be blown out of her mouth. But I have to make sure, when we're done here, that I avoid leaving any trace in my telling of David Carpenter potentially being a sympathetic character to anyone. A cluster. Four bodies found off of the Big Sky Trail. There's no question now that a serial killer is on the loose. Hikers of the Sleeping Lady and beyond need to either take a breather or a bazooka when it comes to hiking those trails. But there's action, even off of them. In late December of 1980, while the bodies of Diane O'Connell and Shauna May are still being processed and the search for the October couple is finally wrapping up, another young woman vanishes. 17-year-old Anna Kelly Menjivar, a high school student and part-time teller at Continental Savings and Loan in Daly City, she leaves home the morning of December 28th and never comes back. Purse, ID, and money left behind, only her house keys are missing. Carpenter was a regular customer at her bank. He came in often, talked to her a lot, hung out with her after work. Co-workers and customers noticed, family did too. Shortly before she disappeared, he had taken her to the warehouse he worked at and gave her keychains. He gave her three ceramic dolls. Her remains, just a jawbone and scattered bones by that point, turned up 6 months later in Castle Rock State Park. Too far gone for a cause of death. Carpenter was the obvious suspect later, but never was charged. I wonder if those dolls he gave her reminded him of the victims he left posed, often described as seeming doll-like by those who stumbled across those victims on the Sleeping Lady. Carpenter has two vehicles. Both will be spotted around crime scenes and in the end help to secure his capture. A light green station wagon for his everyday life, this with the personalized license plate of DJ Carp, David Joseph Carpenter. Carpenter would never be able to use that vehicle in his crime spree. It had his name on it. Well, his DJ name. The car he uses today is a red Fiat. March 29th, 1981. Henry Cowell Redwood State Park, Santa Cruz Mountains. 20-year-old UC Davis students Ellen Hansen and her boyfriend Steve Hurdle are hiking the Ridge Trail. They pass a man once. Later, coming back the same way, they meet him again. Quote from David Carpenter here. "So, we meet again," he says, and pulls out his weapon. Carpenter orders the couple off the trail into the brush. He points the gun at Ellen and says the words that have defined him for years, quote, "I want to rape you." Ellen Hansen looks at him and answers clear and final, "No, I'm not going to let you." Steve tries to bargain with the man. Ellen tells Steve to cut the shit. He's going to kill us either way. Incredibly brave is Ellen, but she's only rewarded with two shots into her head, one into her shoulder. She drops, dead. Then, Carpenter turns the gun on Steve and puts a bullet through the back of his neck as Steve turns to run. The slug bounces around, lodging behind his sternum. Steve goes down and plays dead. Carpenter runs away, believing both are dead. Steve Hartle is not dead. He forces himself up, staggers towards the observation deck that's nearby, and gets help from people who are there. The bullet has shredded nerves in his neck and vocal cords. His voice will never be the same, but he is alive. And he has seen the trailside killer's face. For the first time, David Carpenter has left a living witness. A month later, the trails having gone cold, no one's walking them, Carpenter again is forced to shit where he eats, which is a saying that I don't love. I fucking hate it, honestly, but I'm running out of steam here. So I'll just leave that shit saying here steaming. May 2nd, 1981. Heather Skaggs, 20 years old, works at the same Hayward Trade School where David Carpenter now teaches printing. She needs a car. Carpenter tells her he knows someone selling one cheap in Santa Cruz. He offers to drive her to it, even loan her the money if she's short. He tells her not to tell anyone where she's going. But Heather tells her boyfriend anyways. Heather also gives her boyfriend Carpenter's name and number, just in case he decides to, I don't know, rape and murder her. She jokes. Then she leaves to meet David Carpenter and never comes home. On May 24th, hikers in Big Basin State Park find a nude, decomposing body 136 yards off the road. Dental records confirm it is Heather. Single gunshot to the face at close range. Semen in her vagina. Deposited, they say, around the time of death. Investigators aren't sure about this one. Is it connected? Either way, it's pretty fucked up. The sleeping lady is wide awake, screaming from night terrors. Heather's boyfriend reports her missing and points straight at Carpenter. Detectives pull his record. The composite from Steve Hartle matches. The red Fiat seen leaving the scene matches. He's not as handsome as some of the sketches, but those glasses of his. Does one eye seem more magnified than the other? Has David Carpenter been looking right at them, slowly pirouetting, waiting patiently? The last pick of the dance. Parole officers start talking. A task force forms. On May 14, 1981, agents move in on the house at 38 Sussex Street in San Francisco. Carpenter is arrested outside of his parents' home. He begs them not to hurt him. In his car and house, they find trail maps of every park where bodies have turned up, paperclipped to the exact pages. The .38 revolver that killed untold people, we're not sure how many he killed, is recovered weeks later, buried under broken asphalt in a vacant lot after Carpenter gave it to a pair of bank robbers for safekeeping. Ballistics match. No honor among thieves. David had actually given these criminals his weapon, hoping they would end up caught with it and be pinned for the murders. Shrewd. Not sympathetic. The first trial is moved to Los Angeles for the Santa Cruz crimes, the murders of Ellen Hansen and Heather Skaggs, the attempted murder of Steve Hartle, the attempted rape of Hansen, the rape of Skaggs. Steve Hartle takes the stand. The bullet tore through his neck, as mentioned, had left him with permanent nerve damage. His voice is high, cracked, strained. He has to relive every second. When the prosecutor asks him to identify the man who shot him and killed his girlfriend Ellen, Hartle doesn't hesitate. He stands and points directly at David Carpenter. Carpenter is convicted on all counts. On November 16, 1984, the judge sentences him to death and tells Carpenter, quote, "If ever there was a case for the death penalty, this is that case." The second trial for the five Marin County murders is held in San Diego in 1988. Another death sentence. So you'd think, considering DJ Karp started spinning back in the mid-20th century, that the music certainly has to have stopped by now. But no, David Joseph Carpenter is still alive. Born May 6, 1930, he is 96 years old. For more than 40 years, he sat on San Quentin's death row as California's oldest condemned inmate, still denying every murder. In 2019, California imposed a moratorium on executions. In 2025, when San Quentin's death row was closed and the prison converted to a rehabilitation center, Carpenter was transferred to the California Healthcare Facility in Stockton, California. He still stammers when spoken to, nothing to steady him now, except his walker. The man who once forced hikers to their knees on the sleeping lady and the trails beyond it is now an old man in a medical prison, still drawing breath while the people he left posed in the dirt have been gone for nearly half a century. Death passing him by each day, not bothering to collect, maybe because David Carpenter's soul, long ago, death deemed forfeit.